nearly the entire skeleton. This one had a wishbone like a bird, but its jaws were lined with sharp teeth like a reptile. Whatever this creature was, it seemed to be half reptile, half bird. This Jurassic hybrid was named Archaeopteryx, and it became a sensation. Darwin included it in later editions of The Origin of Species as evidence that birds had a deep history which could be explained only by evolution. The strange fossil also caught the eye of one of Darwin's best friends and most vociferous supporters. Thomas Henry Huxley is perhaps best remembered as the man who came up with the term agnosticism to describe his uncertain religious views. But in the 1860s, he was popularly known as Darwin's Bulldog. It was a nickname he gave himself because he was unrelenting in his defense of Darwin's theory, taking on anyone in person or in print who maligned it. Huxley agreed that Archaeopteryx was a transitional fossil linking reptiles and birds, but he went one step further. He noticed that it bore an uncanny resemblance to another fossil discovered in the same lithographic limestone beds in Bavaria, a small flesh-eating dinosaur called Compsognathus. So he proposed his own radical new idea. Birds descended from dinosaurs. Debate continued for the next century. Some scientists followed Huxley, others didn't accept the link between dinosaurs and birds. Even as a deluge of new dinosaur fossils emerged from the American West, the Jurassic Morrison dinosaurs like Allosaurus and its many sauropod compatriots, the Cretaceous Hell Creek congregation of T-Rex and Triceratops, there didn't seem to be enough evidence to settle the question. Then, in the 1920s, a book by a Danish artist made the simplistic argument that birds couldn't have come from dinosaurs because dinosaurs apparently didn't have collarbones, which birds fuse into wishbones. And although it may sound a little absurd, that viewpoint held sway until the 1960s, and today we realize that dinosaurs did indeed have collarbones, so the point is moot. As Beatlemania swept the globe, protesters marched for civil rights in the American South, and the war raged in Vietnam, the consensus was that dinosaurs had nothing to do with birds. They were just very distant cousins that looked kind of similar. That all changed in 1969, that tumultuous year of Woodstock. Revolution was afoot, as societal norms and traditions were being challenged throughout the West. That spirit of rebellion also percolated into science, and paleontologists started to see dinosaurs differently. Not as the dim-witted, dull-colored, slow-moving wastes of space that defined a pointless era of prehistory, but as more active, dynamic, energetic animals that ruled their world through talent and ingenuity, creatures that were very similar in many ways to living animals, particularly birds. A new generation led by an unassuming Yale professor named John Ostrom and his rambunctious student Robert Bakker completely reimagined dinosaurs, even making the argument that dinosaurs lived together in herds, had keen senses, cared for their young, and may have been warm-blooded like us. The catalyst for this so-called dinosaur renaissance was a series of fossils unearthed a few years before, in the mid-1960s, by Ostrom and his team. They were out in far southern Montana, close to the border with Wyoming, prospecting in colorful rocks formed on a floodplain during the early Cretaceous, sometime between 125 and 100 million years ago. They found over 1,000 bones of a dinosaur that was astonishingly bird-like. It had long arms that looked almost like wings, and the lithe build indicative of a fast-running dynamo of an animal. After a few years of studying the bones, Ostrom announced them in 1969 as a new species, Deinonychus, a raptor. It was a close cousin of Velociraptor, which was discovered in the 1920s in Mongolia and described by Henry Fairfield Osborne, the New York aristocrat who named T-Rex. but in these pre-Jurassic Park times, it had yet to become a household name. Ostrom realized the enormous implications of his find. He used Deinonychus to resurrect Huxley's idea that birds evolved from dinosaurs, which he argued in a series of landmark scientific papers in the 1970s, a lawyer making his case by meticulous presentation of incontrovertible evidence. Meanwhile, his flamboyant former student Bakker went a different route. The cowboy-hatted, hippie-haired child of the 60s became an evangelist. He preached the dinosaur-bird connection, and the new image of dinosaurs as warm-blooded, big-brained evolutionary success stories to the public, with a Scientific American cover story in 1975 and a wildly successful book in the 1980s, The Dinosaur Heresies. Their contrasting styles caused considerable friction between them, but together Ostrom and Bakker revolutionized how everyone viewed dinosaurs. By the end of the 1980s, most serious students of paleontology had come around to their way of thinking. The recognition that birds came from dinosaurs raised a provocative question. Maybe, Ostrom and Bakker surmised, some of the most familiar features of modern birds first evolved in dinosaurs. Perhaps raptors like Deinonychus, so birdy in their bones and body proportions, even had that one thing that is most quintessentially bird. Feathers. After all, because birds evolved from dinosaurs, and because the half-dinosaur, half-bird Archaeopteryx was found covered in fossilized feathers, feathers must have developed somewhere along their evolutionary lineage, maybe in a dinosaur long before birds came onto the scene. Moreover, if some dinosaurs did have feathers, that would be the final jab in the gut to the few old-blood holdovers who didn't accept the connection between dinosaurs and birds. The problem, though, is that Ostrom and Bakker couldn't be sure if dinosaurs like Deinonychus had feathers. All they had were bones, soft bits like skin, muscles, tendons, internal organs, and, yes, feathers, rarely survive the ravages of death, decay, and burial to become fossilized. Archaeopteryx, which Ostrom and Bakker considered the oldest bird in the fossil record, was a lucky exception, having been buried quickly in a quiet lagoon and rapidly turned to stone. Maybe they would never be able to tell one way or another. So they waited, hopeful that somebody, somewhere, somehow, would find feathers on a dinosaur. Then, in 1996, as his career was drawing to a close, Ostrom was at the annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology in New York, where fossil hunters from around the world congregate to present new discoveries and discuss their research. While milling about the American Museum, Ostrom was approached by Phil Curry, a Canadian who was part of that first post-1960s generation raised on the idea that birds are dinosaurs. The theory so fascinated Curry that he spent much of the 1980s and 1990s hunting for small bird-like raptors in western Canada, Mongolia, and China. He had, in fact, just returned from one of his trips to China. While he was there, he caught wind of an extraordinary fossil. He took a photograph of it out of his pocket and showed it to Ostrom. There it was, a small dinosaur surrounded by a halo of feathery fluff, immaculately preserved as if it had died yesterday. Ostrom began to cry. His knees got weak, and he almost fell to the floor. Somebody had found his feathered dinosaur. The fossil Curry showed Ostrom, later named Cynosauropteryx, was only the start. Scientists sprinted to the Liaoning region of northeastern China, where it was found, with the mad ambition of prospectors on a gold rush. But the true authorities were the local farmers. They knew the land intimately and understood that even a single prime specimen, when sold to a museum, could bring them more money than a lifetime of toiling in the fields. Within a few years, farmers from all over the countryside had reported several other feathered dinosaur species, which were given names like Caudipteryx, Protarchaeopteryx, Bapiosaurus, and Microraptor. Today, some two decades later, more than 20 such species are known, and these are represented by thousands of individual fossils. These dinosaurs had the great misfortune to live in a dense forest surrounding a wonderland of ancient lakes, a landscape that was periodically obliterated by volcanoes. Some of these eruptions spewed out tsunamis of ash, which combined with water to flood the landscape in a viscous ooze that buried everything in sight. The dinosaurs were captured going about their everyday business, preserved Pompeii-style. That's why the details of the feathers are so pristine. Ostrom was a guy who waited hours for a bus, only to have 5 come along at once. He now had a whole ecosystem of feathered dinosaurs, which proved him right. Birds really did arise from dinosaurs, an extension of the same family as T-Rex and Velociraptor. The feathered dinosaurs of Liaoning are now among the most celebrated fossils in the world, and rightly so. When it comes to new dinosaur discoveries, nothing in my lifetime approaches their significance. One of the greatest privileges I've had in my career is studying many of the feathered dinosaurs of Liaoning in museums all over China. I've even had the chance to name and describe a new one, the raptor Zhenyuan Long that we met back in the first few pages of this book, that mule-sized creature with wings. These Liaoning dinosaurs are gorgeous fossils, as suited for an art gallery as a natural history museum. But there's so much more than that. They are the fossils that help us untangle one of the biggest riddles of biology, how evolution produces radically new groups of organisms with restyled bodies capable of remarkable new behaviors. The formation of small, fast-growing, warm-blooded flying birds from ancestors that looked like T-Rex and Allosaurus is a prime example of this sort of jump, what biologists call a major evolutionary transition. You need fossils to study major transitions because they're not the sort of thing we can recreate in the lab or witness in nature. The Liaoning dinosaurs are an almost perfect case study. There are a lot of them, and they exhibit great diversity of body size, shape, and feather structure. They run the gamut from dog-sized plant-eating ceratopsians with simple porcupine-style quills to 30-foot-long primitive cousins of T-Rex coated in hair-like fuzz, like Eutyrannus, which we also met a few chapters ago, to raptors like Zhenyuan Long with full-on wings, and even to crow-sized weirdos with wings on both the arms and the legs, something not seen in any modern birds. Each is a snapshot, and when stitched together and placed on a family tree, they provide something of a running film of an evolutionary transition in action. Most fundamentally, the Liaoning fossils confirm where birds perch on the dinosaur family tree. Birds are a type of theropod. They are rooted in that group of ferocious meat-eaters that most famously includes T-Rex and Velociraptor, and also many of the other predators that we've come across. The herd-living Coelophysis from Ghost Ranch, the butcher Allosaurus from the Morrison Formation, the Carcharodontosaurs and Abelosaurids that terrorized the southern continents. This is exactly what Huxley and later Ostrom proposed. The Liaoning fossils sealed the deal by verifying how many features are shared uniquely by birds and other theropods, not just feathers, but also wishbones, three-fingered hands that can fold against the body, and hundreds of other aspects of the skeleton. There are no other groups of animals, living or extinct, that share these things with birds or theropods. This must mean that birds came from theropods. Any other conclusion requires a whole lot of special pleading. Among theropods, birds nest within an advanced group called paravians, These carnivores break some of the stereotypes that many people still hold about dinosaurs, particularly theropods. They weren't lumbering monsters like T-Rex, but smaller, nimbler, smarter species, most of which were human size or tinier. In effect, they were a subgroup of theropods that went on their own path, trading the brawn and girth of their ancestors for bigger brains, keener senses, and more compact, lightweight skeletons that permitted a more active lifestyle. Other paravians include Ostrom's Deinonychus, Velociraptor, and my oh-so-bird-like Zhenyuan Long, along with all of the other dromaeosaurid raptor and troodontid species. These dinosaurs are the closest relatives of birds. They all had feathers, many of them had wings, and more than a few surely looked and acted like modern birds. Somewhere within this flock of paravian species lies the line between non-bird and bird. As with the division between non-dinosaur and dinosaur way back in the Triassic, this distinction is blurry, and it's getting less distinct with each new fossil from Liaoning. Truthfully, it's just a matter of semantics. Today's paleontologists define a bird as anything that falls into the group that includes Huxley's Archaeopteryx, modern birds, and all descendants of their Jurassic common ancestor. It's more historical convention than a reflection of any biological distinction. By this definition, Deinonychus and Zhenyuan Long fall ever so slightly on the non-bird side of the border. Let's forget about that for a second. Definitions can distract from the storyline. Today's birds stand out among all modern animals. Feathers, wings, toothless beaks, wishbones, big heads that bob along on an S-shaped neck, hollow bones, toothpick legs, the list goes on. These signature features define what we call the bird body plan, the blueprint that makes a bird. This body plan is behind the many super skills that birds are so renowned for, their ability to fly, their hypercharged growth rates, their warm-blooded physiology, and their high intelligence and sharp senses. We want to know where this body plan came from. The feathered dinosaurs of Liaoning give us the answer. And it's remarkable. Many of the supposedly signature features of today's birds, the components of their blueprint, first evolved in their dinosaur ancestors. Far from being unique to birds, these features developed much earlier in ground-living theropods for reasons wholly unrelated to flight. Feathers are the best example, and we'll return to them in a moment, but they are merely emblematic of a much bigger pattern. To see it, we have to start at the base of the family tree and move up. Let's begin with a central feature of the bird blueprint. Long, straight legs and feet with three skinny main toes, hallmarks of the modern bird silhouette, first appeared more than 230 million years ago in the most primitive dinosaurs, as their bodies were reshaped into upright walking, fast-running engines that could outpace and outhunt their rivals. In fact, these hind limb features are some of the defining characteristics of all dinosaurs, the very things that helped them rule the world for so long. Then, a little bit later, some of these upright-walking dinosaurs, the earliest members of the theropod dynasty, fused their left and right collarbones into a new structure, the wishbone. It was a seemingly minor change, which stabilized the shoulder girdle and probably allowed these stealthy, dog-sized predators to better absorb the shock forces of grabbing prey. Much later, birds would co-opt the wishbone to serve as a spring that stores energy when they flap their wings. These proto-theropods, however, never could have known this would eventually happen, just as the inventor of the propeller had no idea the Wright brothers would later put it on an airplane. Many tens of millions of years down the line, a subset of these upright-walking, wishbone-chested theropods, called Maniraptorans, developed a gracefully curved neck for reasons unknown. I speculate it may have had something to do with scouting for prey. Meanwhile, some of these species were getting smaller in size, probably because their shrinking physiques gave them entry to new ecological niches, trees, brush, perhaps even underground caves or burrows that were inaccessible to giants like Brontosaurus and Stegosaurus. Later, a subset of these small, upright, wishboned, bobbing-necked theropods started to fold their arms against the body, probably to protect the delicate quill-pen feathers that were evolving around the same time. These were the Paravians, a subgroup of the Maniraptorans and the immediate ancestors of birds. These are just a few examples. There are many more. The point is, when I look at that seagull outside my window, many of the features that allow me to immediately recognize it as a bird are not actually trademarks of birds. They're attributes of dinosaurs. This pattern isn't confined to anatomy either. Many of the most notable behaviors and biological characteristics of living birds also have deep dinosaurian heritage. Some of the best evidence comes not from Liaoning, but from another trove of spectacular fossils found in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia. For the last quarter century, a joint team from the American Museum of Natural History and the Mongolian Academy of Sciences has been mounting annual summer expeditions to this desolate expanse of Central Asia. The fossils they have collected, which date from the late Cretaceous between about 84 and 66 million years ago, provide unprecedented insight into the lifestyles of dinosaurs and early birds. Leading the Gobi Project is one of America's most prominent paleontologists, Mark Norell, the head of the American Museum's dinosaur collection and my former PhD supervisor. Mark grew up in Southern California, a long-haired surfer dude who worshipped Jimmy Page, but at the same time had a nerdy obsession with collecting fossils. He did his graduate work at Yale, where Ostrom was one of his mentors, and was barely into his 30s when he was hired to Barnum Brown's old curatorial post, widely regarded as the top dinosaur research job in the world. The total opposite of a stuffy academic caricature, Mark travels the planet hunting for the two things he knows best. Dinosaurs, obviously, but also his other infatuation, Asian art. The stories he's accumulated along the way, in auction houses, Chinese dance clubs, Mongolian yurts, fancy European hotels, and seedy bars, often seem too outrageous to be true, but make him one of the best raconteurs I've known. A few years ago, the Wall Street Journal published a hagiography of Mark, referring to him as the coolest dude alive. Mark does dress like a hipster version of Andy Warhol, another of his heroes, hold court in a majestic office overlooking Central Park, boast a collection of ancient Buddhist art that puts many museums to shame, and bring portable fridges into the desert so he can make sushi while doing field work. Is it enough to qualify as the single coolest individual in the world? I'll let others judge. I do know that Mark is one of the world's best advisors. He's whip-smart and thinks big, always urging his students to ask fundamental questions about how evolution works. For instance, how did a dinosaur turn into a bird? Never a micromanager or a credit stealer, he tries to attract motivated students, supplies them with kick-ass fossils, and then steps aside. That, and he never lets his students pay for beer. I and many of Mark's students have built our careers studying dinosaurs he wrested from the Gobi. Among them are skeletons entombed by flash storms that captured parent dinosaurs brooding their nests of eggs, just like the birds we know today. They show that birds inherited their superb parenting skills from their dinosaurian antecedents, and that these behaviors go back at least to some of the small, winged, arch-necked Maniraptoran species. Mark's crews have also discovered a wealth of dinosaur skulls, including the well-preserved crania of Velociraptor and other Maniraptorans. CAT scanning of these specimens, spearheaded by Mark's former student Amy Balanoff, who we met a couple of chapters ago, has revealed that these dinosaurs had huge brains, with an expanded forebrain at the front. It is the large forebrain that makes modern birds so intelligent and acts as their in-flight computer, allowing them to control the complicated business of flying and navigating the complex 3D world of the air. We don't precisely know why these Maniraptorans evolved such intelligence, but the Gobi fossils tell us that the ancestors of birds got smart before they took to the skies. The list continues. Numerous theropods found in the Gobi and elsewhere had bones hollowed out by air sacs, which, as we learned earlier, are telltale signs that they had the ultra-efficient flow-through lung that takes in oxygen during both inhalation and exhalation, a precious feature of birds that delivers the juice needed to maintain their high-energy way of life. The microscopic structure of dinosaur bones indicates that many species, including all known theropods, had growth rates and physiologies intermediate between slow-maturing, cold-blooded reptiles and the fast-growing, warm-blooded birds of today. Thus, we now know that a flow-through lung and relatively fast growth emerged more than 100 million years before birds took wing, as those first fast-running, long-legged dinosaurs were carving out a new livelihood as energetic live wires so different from the sluggish amphibians, lizards, and crocodiles they were battling. We even know that both the typical sleeping posture of birds and the way in which they mine calcium from their bones for the shells of their eggs first arose in dinosaurs long before birds. What we think of as the bird body plan, therefore, wasn't so much a fixed blueprint as a Lego set that was put together brick by brick over evolutionary time. The same was true of the classic behavioral, physiological, and biological repertoire of today's birds. And the same was true of feathers. Whenever I visit China, I always make time to see Xuxing. He's a polite, mild-tempered man who grew up poor in Xinjiang, a politically disputed sweep of western China that was once crossed by the Silk Road. Unlike most children in the West, Xu had no interest in dinosaurs when he was young. He didn't even know they existed. When he won a prestigious scholarship to go to college in Beijing, the government told him that he would study paleontology, a subject he had never heard of before. Xu complied and actually enjoyed it. And then he went on to train further under Mark Norell in New York. Today he's the world's greatest dinosaur hunter. He's named more than 50 new species, more than anybody else alive. Compared to Mark's presidential suite in the turret of the American Museum of Natural History, Xu's office at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology in Beijing is Spartan, but it contains some of the most amazing fossils you'll ever see. In addition to the dinosaurs that Xu finds himself, he is routinely sent bones that have been collected by farmers, construction workers, and various other people from all over China. Many of those are new feather-covered dinosaurs from Liaoning. Whenever I visit and stride up to Xu's door, I feel the adrenaline of a kid running into a toy store. The fossils I've seen in Xu's office tell the story of how feathers evolved. More than any other part of a bird's body or biology, feathers are central to figuring out where birds and many of their unique abilities, like flight, came from. Feathers are nature's ultimate Swiss Army knife, multi-purpose tools that can be used for display, insulation, protection for eggs and babies, and, of course, flight. Indeed, they have so many uses that it has been difficult to figure out which purpose they first evolved to serve and how they were modified into airfoils. But the Liaoning fossils are starting to provide an answer. Feathers didn't suddenly spring forth when the first birds entered the scene. They evolved in their distant dinosaurian ancestors. The common ancestor of all dinosaurs may have even been a feathered species, We don't know for sure, because we can't study that ancestor directly, but it's an inference based on an observation. So many small dinosaurs from Liaoning that are well preserved, the bounty of meat-eating theropods like Sinosauropteryx, but also pint-sized plant-eaters like Psittacosaurus, are found coated in some type of integument. Either these various dinosaurs evolved their feathers separately, which is unlikely, or they inherited them from a deep ancestor. These earliest feathers, however, looked very different from the quill pens of modern birds. The material that glazed the body of Sinosauropteryx and most other Liaoning dinosaurs was more like fluff, made up of thousands of hair-like filaments that paleontologists call proto-feathers. No way could these dinosaurs fly. Their feathers were too simple, and they didn't even have wings. So the first feathers must have evolved for something else, probably to keep these small chinchilla-like dinosaurs warm, or maybe as a way to camouflage their bodies. For most dinosaurs, the vast majority of those that I've studied in Xu's office and in other Chinese museums, a coat of fluffy or bristly feathers was enough. However, in one subgroup, those wishboned swan-necked Maniraptorans, the hairy strands became longer and then started to branch, first into a few simple tufts, and then later into a much more orderly system of barbs projecting sideways from a central shaft. Thus, the quill was born, or in scientist speak, the pennaceous feather. Lined up and layered across each other on the arms, these more complex feathers formed wings. Many theropods, particularly paravians, had wings of varying shapes and sizes. Some, like the dromaeosaurid Microraptor, one of the first feathered dinosaurs that Xu named and described, even had wings on both the arms and the legs, something unheard of in today's birds. Wings, of course, are essential for flight. They are the airfoils that provide lift and thrust. For this reason, it was long assumed that wings must have evolved specifically for flight, that some Maniraptorans turned their primitive dino fuzz into sheets of pennaceous quill pens because they were fine-tuning their bodies into airplanes. It's an intuitive explanation, but it's probably false. In 2008, a team of Canadian researchers was prospecting the badlands of southern Alberta, an area rich in fossils of tyrannosaurs, ceratopsians, duckbills, and other last surviving late Cretaceous dinosaurs of North America. At the helm was another polite, even-tempered scientist, Darla Zelenitsky, one of the world's experts on dinosaur eggs and reproduction. Her crew had found the skeleton of a horse-sized ornithomimosaur, a beaked, omnivorous ostrich-mimic theropod, and its body was surrounded by wispy dark streaks, some of which seemed to continue straight onto the bone. If they were in Liaoning, Darla told her team with a snide laugh, they could call these things feathers and announce the find as a career-defining discovery. But they couldn't be feathers. This ornithomimosaur was entombed in a sandstone dumped by a river, not rapidly buried in mint condition by Liaoning-style volcanic surges. Plus, no feathered dinosaurs had ever been reported from North America before. The joke ran its course a year later when Darla and her team, which also included her husband Francois Therrien, an expert on dinosaur ecology, found a nearly identical fossil. Another ornithomimosaur in sandstone with a mange of cotton candy fuzz around it. Something strange was going on, so the duo went into the storehouse of the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology, where Francois is a curator, to check out other ornithomimosaurs in the collection. There they found a third fluffy skeleton that had been discovered in 1995, a year before Phil Curry took that photograph of the first feathered theropod from Liaoning and showed it to John Ostrom. The paleontologists who excavated the Albertan fossil in the mid-1990s didn't yet know that dinosaur feathers could be preserved. But Darla and Francois could tell that the tufts on the three ornithomimosaurs were nearly identical in size, shape, structure, and position to the feathers on many of the Liaoning theropods. This could mean only one thing. They had found the first feathered dinosaurs in North America. The ornithomimosaurs that Darla and Francois discovered didn't merely have feathers. They also had wings. You can clearly see the black splotches on the arm bones where large quill pen-style feathers were anchored, a tidy series of dots and dashes arrayed in lines all up and down the forearm. There's no way this dinosaur could fly, though. It was far too big and heavy, and its arms were far too short, and its wings too small to provide a large enough surface area to support the animal in the air. Moreover, it didn't have the huge chest muscles necessary to power flight, the breast muscles of today's birds, whose massive sizes make them good eating, nor the asymmetrical feathers, with a leading vane shorter and stiffer than the trailing vane, that are necessary to withstand the severe forces of surging through an airstream. The same turns out to be true of many of the winged theropods of Liaoning, including Zhenyuan Long. They had wings, sure, but their hefty bodies, pathetically undersized wings, and puny frames made them wholly unsuitable for the air. But why else would a dinosaur develop wings? It may seem like a conundrum, but we have to remember that today's birds use their wings for many things other than flying, which is why, for instance, flightless birds like ostriches don't lose their arms entirely. They are also used as display structures to entice mates and frighten rivals, as stabilizers that help birds climb, as fins to help them swim, and as blankets for keeping eggs warm in the nest, along with many other functions. Wings could have evolved for any of these reasons, or maybe another function entirely. But display seems the most likely, and there is growing evidence for it. When I was doing my PhD with Mark Norell in New York, there was another student working on his degree a couple of hours north at Yale, in the same department that Ostrom taught in before his death in 2005. Jakob Winther comes from Denmark, and he has the Viking physique to prove it. He's tall, with sandy blonde hair, a big bushy beard, and intense Nordic eyes. Jakob never intended to study dinosaurs. He yearns for the Cambrian period, that time a few hundred million years before the dinosaurs, when life in the oceans was undergoing its Big Bang. While studying these ancient animals, Jakob started to wonder about how fossil preservation works on the microscopic scale. He began to look at lots of different fossils under high-powered microscopes and realized that many of them preserved a variety of small, bubble-like structures. Comparisons to modern animal tissues showed these to be melanosomes, pigment-bearing vessels. Because melanosomes of different size and shape correspond to different colors, sausage-shaped ones make black, meatball-shaped ones a rusty red, and so on, Jakob gathered that by looking at fossilized melanosomes, you could tell what colors prehistoric animals would have been when they were alive. We were always told this was impossible, but Jakob proved the experts wrong. In my mind, it's one of the cleverest things a paleontologist has ever done in my lifetime. Naturally, Jakob decided to take a gander at the newly discovered feathered dinosaurs. If the feathers were preserved well enough, he hoped, they might contain melanosomes. One by one, Jakob and his colleagues in China put the Liaoning dinosaurs under the microscope, and his hunch was proven correct. They found melanosomes everywhere, of all shapes and sizes, orientations, and distributions, which reveal that the feathers of non-flying winged dinosaurs were a rainbow of different colors. Some were even iridescent, like those of today's shiny-sheened crows. Colorful wings like these would have been perfect display instruments, just like the fabulous tail of a peacock. Although it doesn't definitively prove that these dinosaurs were using their wings for display, it is solid circumstantial evidence. The totality of the evidence, that wings first evolved in dinosaurs too large and ungainly to fly, that these wings were ornately colored, and that modern birds used their wings for display, has led to a radical new hypothesis. Wings originally evolved as display structures, as advertising billboards projecting from the arms and, in some cases, like Microraptor, the legs and even the tail. Then these fashionably winged dinosaurs would have found themselves with big, broad surfaces that by the unbreakable laws of physics could produce lift and drag and thrust. The earliest winged dinosaurs, like the horse-sized ornithomimosaurs, and even most raptors like Zhenyuan Long, probably would have considered the lift and drag produced by their billboards to be little more than an annoyance. In any case, whatever lift was generated wasn't nearly enough to get such large animals into the air. But in more advanced paravians, which had the magic combination of bigger wings and smaller body size, the billboards would have been able to take on an aerodynamic function. These dinosaurs could now move around in the air, even if awkwardly at first. Flight had evolved, and it had happened totally by accident, the billboards now repurposed as airfoils. The more fossils we find, particularly in Liaoning, the more complex the story gets. The early development of flight appears to have been chaotic. There was no orderly progression, no long evolutionary march in which one subgroup of dinosaurs was refined into ever better aeronauts. Instead, evolution had produced a general type of dinosaur. Small, feathered, winged, fast-growing, efficient breathing that had all of the attributes needed to start playing around in the air. There seems to have been a zone on the dinosaur family tree where this type of animal had free rein to experiment. Flight probably evolved many times in parallel, as different species of these dinosaurs, with their different airfoil and feather arrangements, found themselves generating lift from their wings as they leaped from the ground, scurried up trees, or jumped between branches. Some of them were gliders, able only to soar passively on air currents. Microraptor undoubtedly could glide, as its arm and leg wings were big enough to support its body in the air. This isn't just conjecture, but has been demonstrated by experiments in which scientists have built anatomically correct, life-size models and stuck them in wind tunnels. Not only do they submissively stay afloat, but they're pretty good at coasting in the airflow. There's also another type of dinosaur that could probably glide, but in a much different way than Microraptor. The tiny Yi-Chi, maybe the wackiest dinosaur ever found, had a wing, but not made of feathers. Instead, it had a membrane of skin stretching between its fingers and body like a bat. This membrane must have been a flight structure, but it was not flexible enough to actively flap, so gliding is really the only possibility. The fact that Microraptor and Yi have such divergent wing configurations is some of the strongest evidence that different dinosaurs were evolving distinct flight styles independently of one another. Other feathered dinosaurs would have started flying in a different way, by flapping. This is called powered flight because the animal actively generates lift and thrust by beating its wings. Mathematical models suggest that some non-bird dinosaurs were plausible flappers, including Microraptor and the troodontid Anchiornis, as both had wings big enough and a body light enough that flapping could have powered them through the air, at least theoretically. These first attempts probably would have been awkward, as these dinosaurs wouldn't have had the muscle strength or stamina to stay in the sky very long, but they provided evolution with a starting point. Now, with these big-winged, small-bodied dinosaurs fluttering around, natural selection could get to work and modify these creatures into better flyers. One of these wing-beating lineages may be the descendants of Microraptor or Anchiornis, or one that evolved completely separately, got even smaller, developed bigger chest muscles and hyper-elongated arms. They lost their tails and teeth, ditched one of their ovaries, and hollowed out their bones even more to lessen their weight. Their breathing became more efficient, their growth faster, and their metabolism more supercharged so that they became fully warm-blooded, able to maintain a constant high internal body temperature. With each evolutionary enhancement, they became even better flyers, some able to stay airborne for hours on end, others able to sail through the oxygen-starved upper reaches of the troposphere over the rising Himalayas. These were the dinosaurs that became the birds of today. Evolution made birds from dinosaurs. And as we've seen, it happened slowly, as one lineage of theropod dinosaurs acquired the characteristic features and behaviors of today's birds piecemeal over tens of millions of years. A T-Rex didn't just mutate into a chicken one day, but rather the transition was so gradual that dinosaurs and birds just seemed to blend into each other on the family tree. Velociraptor, Deinonychus, and Genuan Long are on that non-bird side of the genealogy, but were they around today, we would probably consider them just another type of bird, no stranger than a turkey or an ostrich. They had feathers, they had wings, they guarded their nests and cared for their babies, and hell, some of them could probably even fly a little bit. During the tens of millions of years that dinosaurs were evolving the signature features of birds, one by one, there was no long game, no greater aim. There was no force guiding evolution to make these dinosaurs ever more adapted to the skies. Evolution works only in the moment, naturally selecting features and behaviors that make an animal successful in its particular time and place. Flight was something that just kind of happened when the time was right. It may have even gotten to the point where it was inevitable. If evolution manufactures a small, long-armed, big-brain hunter with feathers to keep warm and wings to woo mates, it doesn't take very much for that animal to start flapping around in the air. In that moment, working with a fluttering dinosaur with some awkward aerial ability, struggling to survive in a dinosaur-eat-dinosaur world, natural selection could kick in and start shaping its progeny into even better flyers. With each additional refinement, you would have something that could fly better, farther, faster, until a modern-style bird had emerged. The culmination of this long transition was a game-changer in the history of life. When evolution had finally succeeded in assembling a small, winged, flying dinosaur, a great new potential was unlocked. These first birds began to diversify like crazy, probably because they had evolved a new ability that allowed them to invade novel habitats and live a different lifestyle than their predecessors. We can see this relatively sudden change in the fossil record. As part of my PhD project, I joined forces with two number crunchers to assess how rates of evolution changed across the dinosaur-bird transition. Graham Lloyd and Steve Wong are paleontologists, but I don't know if either of them has ever collected a fossil. They are first-rate statisticians, math whizzes who take joy in sitting in front of their computers for hours, writing code and running analyses. The three of us worked together to devise a new way of calculating how fast or slow animals change features of their skeletons over time, and how these rates change branch by branch on the family tree. We started with the big new genealogy of birds and their closest theropod cousins that I produced with Mark Norell. We then made a vast database of anatomical features that vary in these animals. Some species, for example, have teeth, but others a beak. By mapping the distribution of these characteristics onto the family tree, we could see where one condition changed into another, where teeth gave way to beaks, and so on. This allowed us to count up how many changes occurred on each branch of the tree. We could also figure out how much time each branch on the tree represented by using the ages of each fossil. Change over time is rate, and thus we could measure the pace of evolution for each branch. Then, using Graham and Steve's statistical know-how, we could test whether certain time intervals in dinosaur-bird evolution or certain groups on the family tree had higher rates of change than others. The results were about as clear as anything I've ever seen spit out of a statistics software program. Most theropods were evolving at ho-hum background rates, but then, once an airworthy bird had emerged, the rates went into overdrive. The first birds were evolving much faster than their dinosaur ancestors and cousins, and they maintained these accelerated rates for many tens of millions of years. Meanwhile, other studies have shown that there was a sudden decrease in body size and a spike in rates of limb evolution right around this same point on the genealogy, as these first birds were quickly getting smaller and growing longer arms and bigger wings so that they could fly better. Although it had taken tens of millions of years for evolution to make a flying bird out of a dinosaur, now things were happening very fast. And birds were soaring. A quick walk from Xu Xing's office in Beijing is another room, brighter and less solemn, but with fewer fossils. It's where Jingmei O'Connor works, but only part of the time. The reason there aren't many fossils here is because Jingmei studies Liaoning birds, the bona fide flyers that flapped over the heads of the feathered dinosaurs, and most of these are crushed onto limestone slabs, so she can describe and measure them from photographs blown up on her computer screen. That means she can easily work from home, which is deep among the last remaining Beijing hutongs, traditional narrow-alleyed neighborhoods of single-story stone buildings pasted together. Good thing, too, because she spends a lot of her non-science time hanging about in the hutongs, raving and even occasionally DJing in the trendy clubs of China's suddenly hip capital. Jingmei calls herself a paleontologista. Fitting, given her fashionista style of leopard print lycra, piercings, and tattoos, all of which are at home in the club, but stand out, in a good way, among the plaid and beard crowd that dominates academia. A native of Southern California, half Irish, half Chinese by blood, Jingmei is a Roman candle of energy, delivering caustic one-liners one moment, speaking in eloquent paragraphs about politics the next, and then it's on to music or art or her own unique personal brand of Buddhist philosophy. Oh, yes, and she's also the world's number one expert on those first birds that broke the bounds of Earth to fly above their dinosaur ancestors. Many birds lived during the age of dinosaurs. The first flapping flyers must have originated sometime before 150 million years ago, because that is the age of Archaeopteryx, Huxley's Frankenstein creature, which is still, as far as we know, the very oldest true bird unarguably capable of powered flight in the fossil record. Most likely, evolution had already assembled a small, winged, flapping, bona fide bird sometime in the middle part of the Jurassic period, around 170 to 160 million years ago. That means there was a good 100 million years during which birds coexisted with their dinosaur predecessors. 100 million years is a lot of time to attain a lot of diversity, particularly as these early birds were evolving at such fast rates compared to other dinosaurs. The Liaoning birds that Jingmei studies are a snapshot of this Mesozoic aviary, the best portrait of what birds were doing during the earliest years of their evolutionary history. Every week, middlemen and museum curators from all over China send photographs to Jingmei and her colleagues in Beijing of new bird fossils plucked from the rolling fields of northeastern China by farmers. Thousands of these fossils have been reported over the last two decades, and they are much more common than feathered dinosaurs like Microraptor and Zhenyuan Long. It's probably because flocks of primitive birds were suffocated by noxious gases from the big volcanic eruptions, and their limp bodies then fell into the lakes and forests that were buried by the ashy sludge that also entombed the feathered dinosaurs. Week after week, Jingmei opens her email, downloads the photographs, and finds herself staring at a new type of bird. These birds include countless species. Jingmei seems to be naming a new one every month or two. They live in the trees, on the ground, and even in and around the water like ducks. Some of these still had teeth and long tails, retained from their velociraptor-like forebears, whereas others had the tiny bodies, huge breast muscles, stubby tails, and majestic wings of modern birds. Meanwhile, gliding and gawkily flapping alongside these birds were some of those other dinosaurs experimenting with flight. The four-winged microraptor, the bat-winged species, and so on. This is more or less where things stood 66 million years ago. This whole suite of birds and other airborne dinosaurs was there, gliding and flapping overhead when T-Rex and Triceratops were duking it out in North America, Carcharodontosaurs were chasing Titanosaurs south of the equator, and dwarf dinosaurs were hopping across the islands of Europe. And then they witnessed what came next, the instant that snuffed out almost all of the dinosaurs, all but a few of the most advanced, best-adapted, best-flying birds, which made it through the carnage and are still with us today. Among them, the seagulls outside my window. 9. Dinosaurs die out. It was the worst day in the history of our planet. A few hours of unimaginable violence that undid more than 150 million years of evolution and set life on a new course. T-Rex was there to witness it. When a pack of Rexes woke up that morning 66 million years ago on what would go down as the final day of the Cretaceous period, all seemed normal in their Hell Creek kingdom, the same as it had for generations, for millions of years. Forests of conifers and ginkgos stretched to the horizon, interspersed with the bright flowers of palms and magnolias. The distant churn of a river, rushing eastward to empty into the great seaway that lapped against western North America, was drowned out by the low bellow of a herd of triceratops, several thousand strong. As the pack of T-Rex readied themselves for the hunt, sunlight began to trickle through the forest canopy. It highlighted the outlines of various small critters darting through the sky, some flapping their feathered wings and others gliding on currents of hot air rising from the humidity of the young day. Their chirps and tweets were beautiful, a dawn symphony that could be heard by all the other creatures of the forest and floodplains, armored ankylosaurs and dome-headed pachycephalosaurs hiding in the trees, legions of duckbills just beginning their breakfast of flowers and leaves, raptors chasing mouse-sized mammals and lizards through the brush. Then things started to get weird, truly outside all norms of Earth history. For the last several weeks, the more perceptive of the Rexes may have noticed a glowing orb in the sky, far off in the distance, a hazy ball with a fiery rim, like a duller and smaller version of the sun. The orb seemed to be getting larger, but then it would disappear from view for large portions of the day. The Rexes wouldn't have known what to make of it. It was far beyond their brain power to contemplate the motions of the heavens. But this morning, as the pack broke through the trees and emerged onto the riverbank, all of them could see that something was different. The orb was back, and it was gigantic, its shine illuminating much of the sky to the southeast in a cloudy, psychedelic mist. Then, a flash. No noise, only a split-second flare of yellow that lit up the whole sky, disorienting the Rexes for a moment. As they blinked their eyes back to focus, they noticed that the orb was now gone, the sky a dull blue. The alpha male turned to check on the rest of his pack. And then they were blindsided. Another flash, but this one far more vengeful. The rays lit the morning air in a fireworks display and burned into their retinas. One of the juvenile males fell over, cracking his ribs. The rest of them stood frozen, blinking maniacally, trying to rid themselves of the sparks and speckles that flooded their vision. Still no sound to go with the visual fury. In fact, no noise at all. By now the birds and flying raptors had stopped chirping, and silence hung over Hell Creek. The calm lasted for only a few seconds. Next, the ground beneath their feet started to rumble, then to shake, and then to flow, like waves. Pulses of energy were shooting through the rocks and soil.